Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight-loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight-loss. PlushCare.com/weight-loss.
Hi, welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name is Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Tony Evans of the Evening Standard and David Preece, the former Aberdeen and Sunderland goalkeeper. All aboard the Magic Roundabout. Apparently, it's the turn of David Moyes to climb back on at West Ham. They've just sacked Slaven Bilic, the fans are underwhelmed, and the board have a summer wish list of Marco Silva, Manuel Pellegrini, and Roberto Mancini. Same old, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, chaos at West Ham. Not much surprising me there, but it seems the wish list isn't that much more positive than the appointment now. I think David Moyes, he wouldn't be my choice, but he's available, so they don't have to pay anyone anything. So that will be a huge consideration. And to be fair to him, I don't think you can judge him on Man United or Sunderland. I mean, two managers on, United are still, you know, scrambling for stability. And Sunderland, you know, it was a poison chalice. They promised him money when he was appointed. He never got it. And if ever a team needs a money spent, then it was Sunderland.
Mm. Sunderland's a club you know well. He was beaten from the start there, wasn't he?
He was, but also he didn't help himself. You know, I'm scarred from his time there, so he's probably asking the wrong person. But it was from the start, it was a case of him surrendering, really. And it's not what the fans want to hear. Whether he's being, you can praise him for being truthful and honest about the situation, that's all right. But it's not what the fans wanted to hear. And it sort of sent the club on a sort of downward trajectory. And you're right, it was always going to be problematic there. He was never going to really be able to do as good a job as what he's probably capable of. But I don't know. I think he's probably one of those managers who's lost that little bit of fire now. Leon Osman spoke about that when at the time he was at Everton. He had the eyeballs bulging, the veins of his neck coming out. You know, and he was pushing his team on. You've not seen that since he left Everton. And there's a few managers talk about this. They talk about losing the fire, after they've had a few jobs. And I think it might be the case with David Moyes.
Yeah. It was interesting because I think David's got a point there. When he was Sunderland manager, I saw them a few times. And in the press conferences afterwards, he was sort of, he looked depressed. He was monosyllabic. You know, it wasn't, you know, there was not even any anger there. It was just slumped.
Mm. Is that part of a wider problem? You know, I saw on social media, it was Daniel Storey came out with this stat that 7 out of the last 13 Premier League appointments have been of British managers aged between 50 and 70. It's the old boys club.
Yeah, but it's always been that way, hasn't it? You know, it's
not good though, is it?
It's not good. But you know, you go back to the 90s, and you know, Ron Atkinson was recycled about 200 times. You know, I think he managed every club, and you know, the 92. But yeah, it happens, and it's because the I think the board's football clubs, in my experience, very creative in terms of
things. No imagination.
No imagination. And, you know, there are lots of managers in the lower leagues who have been successful. But the thing is, people look at them from the viewpoint of the Premier League and they don't see their achievements. You know, they say, oh, you know, it's only down there. And they're not really paying attention. So they're more likely to pick a name they know rather than someone who's actually got a bit of ability and a bit of life about them.
Mm, but if you look at the top of the Championship, which is that glass ceiling, isn't it? You've got young managers like Lee Johnson at Bristol City, Gary Rowett's proving himself at Derby, Gary Monk's rebuilding his reputation at Middlesbrough. Why not take a punt on one of those?
You're right, but I mean, they still need that experience. And you think, you know, if you look at football management as an education, you know, the older you get, the more you learn. And I go back to that losing the fire and that sort of the eagerness to coach people and to teach people new things. Sometimes you get a little bit lazy and managers start to assume that players already know these things and they've got to stop repeating themselves. When sometimes, you know, you've got to keep giving footballers the basics, bring them back all the time and just not assume that they know everything that you do. But you're right about the young managers there. There's a lot of young managers in the Championship now. Paul Heckenbottom of Barnsley is another one. Mm.
Chris Wilder at Sheffield United.
Exactly, yeah. So it's not like there's no talent there to be brought in. Maybe people can see it's a bit of a gamble, and that's because of the money that's at stake now. I mean, you see the styles of football that some people are playing. People are becoming very safe. Even Bournemouth are coming very defensive, going away from the football that they've played that got them there. So there's a lot of pressure going on to managers and to owners to make sure they get the right appointments. Mm.
So if we're saying, basically, the Premier League is drunk on money, when's the hangover going to kick in?
No, I think we're some way away from that. I think certainly I can see the next two cycles of the television deals going up as more platforms come in. You know, sort of people like Facebook and Google are talking, you know, about it. I mean, the money's going to go up, so it's only going to get worse.
Mm. But do you think that we will ever get to the point where we will be able to trust our own? Or is it still going to be a fashion business where a foreign coach who... By common consent, they really present well when they're doing job interviews. They're almost like the sexy option.
Oh, no, what'll happen is there'll be a good young English coach come through and he'll be really successful, and then it'll be a classic football thing, you know, monkey see, monkey do. Everyone will be looking for English coaches. You know, it'll happen at some point. And then, you know, foreign coaches will be out of fashion.
You know Lee Johnson quite well, don't you?
Yeah, and his assistant, Jim McAllister, and also Paul Heckenbottom as well. And in Lee's case, you know, even in the short space of time that, you know, he'd been at Oldham, Barnsley, now Bristol City, it hasn't all been sort of plain sailing. You know, he had a tough time at Barnsley and even last season at Bristol City. But he had, in both cases, chairman who trusted him and stuck with him through those tough times as well. And that's what English managers need. I mean, I was surprised at all the stick that David Unsworth's been getting, simply because it was kind of like, all right, the results haven't been good, the performances haven't been good, OK? But even before the results had turned negatively, they all seem to be like a little bit sort of... Some people are just quick to criticise all the time when really, it is a big step for him. And whether he should get the job or not, that's a different matter. But the fact there should be more encouragement to English coaches, I found that really disappointing. Mm.
The reality is he won't get the job, will he, Tony?
Well, no, and I don't think he should. I don't think he's good enough. I mean, you know, and I don't think it's an issue with his weight either.
No, that was the nonsense, I have to say.
But I think he's still in his learning process, and I don't think he's... qualified to manage a club like Everton at this stage.
Looks like Sam Allardyce is now the favourite, and there's talk of Craig Shakespeare going with him as his number two. Mm. To be perfectly honest, I'm really underwhelmed by that. We know why they're going to do it, to keep him in the division. He'll spend 18 months there, and then they'll all start again.
Yeah, I mean, I think it won't address the underlying problems there. You know, Allardyce will come in, he'll organise them and they'll do enough. They should have enough to stay up anyway. It shouldn't be a problem. But, you know, they need a wider revamp. They need to... I mean, they bought so little pace during the summer. No striker. You know, they need someone to build for the future. And Allardyce is just going to... You know, he's going to be a plaster over the wounds. But the wounds will still be there.
Mm. The irony being, out of all that summer recruitment, the only one who's really fulfilled himself is Pickford, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's simply because he's had to, because he's been so busy. And yeah. I mean, it's worrying as well. You mentioned Jordan there. It's worrying that there's him, Joe Hart, Jack Butland, playing for the three teams with the worst defensive records. Conceded the most goals, and that's a bit of a worry coming into a World Cup. When at the start of the season we're thinking we've got a wealth of riches here, and you're thinking Jordan Pickford or Butland, but coming to that tournament, and some of you don't want to be shot to pieces.
You're Gareth Southgate. Who's your number one going into the World Cup?
At the minute, I'd go for Butland, but you can see now that maybe he's becoming a little bit jaded by what's happened at Stoke. Okay, like Man City last week, you know, people are going to get passed around. It's irrelevant who's in goal when Man City are playing like that. But Jordan Pickford's one that's, you know, despite what's going on, he's still conceding goals, but he's making a hell of a lot of saves, and he's still looking the confident lad that went there in the summer. Mm. And I think over the course of the season, it'll be interesting, you know, see if the battle between Butland and Pickford for the number one spot.
Well, I mean, the thing about Pickford, he'll make mistakes, but he's really willing to learn. Mm. And he's in games, he doesn't let the mistakes get to him. Mm. But afterwards, he'll go back and he'll talk about it and try and correct himself. I don't think this experience at Everton, as bad as it is, will do him any harm long term.
No, it's what he's used to. No, he used to have a lot of work done at Sunderland, you know. So he's going for, it's not like the people talking about the problem he might have is when he goes to a bigger club, top of the league, having less to do, and then it's more about the mental side of the game than it is being involved making saves. So we thought that might be a problem, but he hasn't had to worry about that so far.
You're not saying Everton are a small club, are you?
No, I'm saying I wasn't saying that at all.
The hate mail.
But they're not the challenger for the top six like they wanted to at the start of the season.
They'll blame me, you know.
Because were Everton built up into something that they're not in the summer? Because there was all this talk about, yeah, OK, we'll go from seventh, they're going to make a bid for the top six, the top four.
I think the exaggerated the progression. I mean, I was one of those people who thought they bought reasonably well, and I thought they'd be doing better than they did. But I mean, it was clear that the lack of a striker and not addressing the sort of dearth of pace in the back four. I mean, they had so much pace and width from the fullbacks over the years, but suddenly they've got old. You know, and of course the centre halves are so immobile. You know, they look as if they're fossilising on the pitch.
But interesting, Michael Keane's got back into the England squad this morning. You know, as an injury replacement. What puzzles me about the Everton situation, Dave, is Sean Dyche. Now, to my very small brain, he is a no-brainer because he has produced over 5 years at Burnley. He is exactly the sort of coach that they need in their current state, and he will take that club forward. He needs a bigger stage, with the greatest respect to Burnley. Why on earth don't they go for him?
I think they've got to look at things from another perspective, whereas they've got to have continuity in the club. They've got to, whoever's in charge of sort of the ethos, or the philosophy of the way they play, and the direction that they want to take the club in. It's a big leap going from Koeman to Dyche. And then if Dyche doesn't work out, there's going to be... I mean, the playing staff they've got there at the moment isn't exactly what you would call a classic Sean Dyche side. So there's going to have to be some movement in January. Now, if there's a massive overhaul and then it doesn't work out, then they go to another type. I mean, this is why I was saying with Sam Allardyce. It's all right going in there saying, well, he will do this job and he will keep them up. That's OK. That's short term. But they haven't really got the personnel to be able to make a big change. I mean, even January, you'd imagine they get a few Sam Allardyce types in January, like you did at Sunderland. You got Coney in and did a great job from Kasri to provide some assists. But they're it doesn't look like Sam Allardyce or Sean Dyche side at the moment. That's my biggest worry.
But you look at Dyche, look what he's done to Tarkowski, turning him into a terrific, you know, one of the most effective centre-halves in the Premier League now.
Yeah, I mean, I think he'd be an excellent choice for them. And especially, you look what he's done at Burnley. He's got ownership there that won't spend any money. They were quite happy if they go down and bounce back. And the other advantage for Dyche Everton is that if they do go down, he knows how to bring a team back up.
You shouldn't smile so much, mate. What about the problems, Dave, when a club is created in the image of its manager? Now, I'm thinking at the moment of West Brom and Tony Pulis. His record is awful recently. 3 wins in 23, hasn't won in 10. There is pressure on him, and the style of his management makes it very difficult to get rid of him, doesn't it?
It does, and also when people talk about the style of football, it's people, if you're winning games under somebody like Pulis, who's not great to look at, not track of football, it's okay when you're winning, people accept it when you're winning. And when you're not winning, you know, that's they just want rid of you. And I know that, you know, speaking to the lads at West Brom, there's no plan to change the way that they're going to play. They're not going to get more expansive. They're not going to be playing any football in their own half. It's nothing's going to change there. So the only way that things could change now is if they brought more people in January. Again, we talk about recruitment. And they're missing Dawson now, who's very, very good right back, very good centre half, but he's also good for a goal for set pieces. Mm-hmm. So they're losing that, and that's the sort of the core of their game, where they get their success from. And you know, when you're losing people like Ashley McCauley as well, you know, he's not getting any younger. So there's going to have to be plenty of changes there if anything's going to happen. But it looks as if it's reached a bit of a tipping point. Once you lose the fans and they start going against you, it's very hard to take that back.
Yeah, it's a classic stick or twist situation, isn't it?
Sam? Yeah, well, I'm surprised it's gone on so long, because there was noises coming out of the Hawthorns, you know, because at the beginning of last season, never mind this season, that the Pulis era was coming towards its end. And it's funny, isn't it? Like Pulis, the pound shot Mourinho, has run out of steam at the same time as perhaps Jose has.
Well, there we are. Young managers, young coaches need Paul Clement to succeed. Mm. He's making it tough for everyone, isn't he?
He is. All right, I watched a couple of games end of last season and see the effect that he had. Again, you know, talk about the Flossies Club and changing. Swansea have gone from this passing side that's 600-700 passes in a game, and I think the third most passes now behind Man City, and it's a situation where now they kind of don't know who they are, don't know what kind of club they are, what type of side they are. Maybe he's been too pragmatic, and the business in the summer. You know, we keep going back to recruitment now, but the business they did in the summer, you know, bringing Boney back at a late stage. I know everything hinged on Gylfi Sigurdsson. When he left, and sort of the long drawn out saga of his leaving to go to Everton, nothing went well from the summer.
It's interesting. You talk about managers losing their fire. Wilfried Bony was completely extinguished the moment he went to Man City and got his move.
His career should serve as a warning to players, because you know he was superb, wasn't he, at Swansea, and then barely got a game at City. I think the problem that, funnily enough, David said it, but you know the number of people in football who say to you about Swansea, they don't know who they are. They don't know what they're trying to do. And I think it shows the lack of a coherent plan on the pitch, and the lack of the players being aware of what their responsibilities are.
But I think it's also to do with upstairs as well, simply because...
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, they've got new American owners.
Yeah.
The American owners are investing a lot, both sort of philosophically and financially, in a data analytic approach. You've got Paul Clement, who is a terrific development coach, if nothing else. But if there's not the budget to get the right players in, look at Roque Mesa. He's probably going to end up going back to La Liga without laying a hand on the Premier League.
You know, this is one of the problems with the American owners. They come in, they go, you know what? We're brighter than everyone else. We can find an angle. You know, the football's not very clever. And just watch us. We find a way to... And they come in and they apply their principles and they don't work. Mm. Well, you know... They more often than not don't work. And he's in this situation where the recruitment in the summer was shocking.
I feel for Paul Clement. You know, I watched him work, and there's someone who I think, in general terms, the English game needs to succeed.
Yeah, I mean, cause he's got great experience, you know, that he's learnt a lot under, obviously...
Well, he's someone who's come from grassroots football, worked at development level with the academies, then coached with a master manager... And now he's having a go on his own. Why not? Why not support him?
Oh, no, he needs it. Of course he does. And I think that, like you said about, you know, talk about Undreth, and you've got to have time. He's a new manager, even though he's got all this experience from grassroots all the way up, and obviously with Ancelotti and going to Madrid and Bayern Munich, you know, he's out there on his own and he's still learning on the job. And sometimes you have an idea about how you're going to play football and what you're going to do. But once you get into the job, it's quite often a whole different matter. Mm. And you sort of, you're being moulded about what's happening around you, rather than being able to do what you want to do.
The best of truth is you come in with a philosophy, but most managers are 8 games away from the sack.
Mm. So, unless you're Jose Mourinho.
Yeah, unless you're...
But last 11 games, away games against the top six, he's lost, but he hasn't won. You looked at that side again at Chelsea and you were there. That was a sense of a team, really, which wasn't playing to its strengths. Do you agree with that?
Well, yeah, without a doubt. It was, although they were more positive than they were, say, for example, at Anfield, which was grim. There was a sense that they were on a tight rein. You know, he never cut them loose. So he's got so much pace available to him, and yet they never use it. They don't seem to play to Lukaku's strengths, and it was all. I mean, Mkhitaryan in the centre was a passenger. I just didn't get a feeling that I understood what this team were trying to do.
Mm. With United, how much are they missing Pogba?
I'm not sure how much they're missing him, whether that makes a difference at all, simply because I think he'd play the same regardless. I think it's probably a mistake that yesterday they were a little bit more open. They played a little bit more football, and I probably think that's a bit more of a mistake. I'd rather he stuck by his core principles and just defended the hell out of it and then get a result. I mean, I didn't mind that at Liverpool at all. You know, I'd say exactly what he was trying to do. He doesn't want to lose and then maybe get a...
But hasn't the game changed, though? City have changed the game. You can't do that anymore.
Yeah, but maybe... I think perhaps they might have scared him into doing it. You know, he's so scared of getting beat now that he wants to go out there and just defend the hell out of it. And when it doesn't work, like yesterday, and they don't get the results, okay, then he's open to criticism. But I think, they've scared everybody now.
Well, here's where I will disagree with David, because I do mind what happens at Liverpool, because Liverpool's defence was so vulnerable. Mm. And, and instead of attacking them, in the first 10 minutes, they sort of went down Moreno's wing a couple of times and you thought, oh, here's the plan. Yeah, you can see how that's going to turn out. And then they went back into a shell. When games are winnable, try and win them. When you think they're not, I don't mind defending. I think it's brilliant when you see a side who outmatched, go somewhere and get results. But when the games are winnable, and the thing is that this game was winnable at Stamford Bridge because Chelsea are in a little bit of disarray themselves. I also think Pogba makes a difference to them because he gives them some thrust and pace in the midfield, and also he makes Matic look good. We saw. In Matic's last year at Stamford Bridge, we saw how one-dimensional he was, and he was one-dimensional again at the Bridge yesterday. Mm.
What was Mourinho's mood like afterwards when he came down to see the guys?
His mood's never great after a defeat, is it?
But was he defiant, or was he a bit surly or sullen?
He's surly. He looks like a man who's worn down by football. He doesn't have that spur he had, a decade ago when, even in defeats he'd have a quip and there was a sort of a little bit of sense of self-parody about him. Now he's miserable.
Mm. Whereas Antonio Conte, that was self-fulfillment yesterday, wasn't it? He made his point about David Luiz dropping him and he got the win.
Yeah, I mean... Some might see it as a gamble, but I mean, if you've watched him this season, I'd been won over by David Luiz last year. I thought he was tremendous last year. He seemed to have reined in sort of the mistakes, became a little bit more disciplined. The three at the back suited him because he was the one who could be a little bit more free, and he wasn't wasn't tied down to defensive duties as much. So he got away with it and he got the best out of him. This season, just being back to his former self for the first time he was at Chelsea. And I think that it was a great decision to bring Christensen because he had a great game yesterday. Mm.
What's the impact in a dressing room, Dave, when a manager makes a big decision and basically clips a big player around the ear?
I think it depends on what the rest of the squad's think about it. Now, if the rest of the squad are thinking that... David Luiz is sort of swanning about and he's not pulling his weight and he is a bit of a liability, then it can, it could give the manager more respect. If it's somebody that's well-liked and they don't think it's warranted, then it can harm him. But I think seeing yesterday it was a right response and they can see that... I don't think anybody is in any doubt about Conte's authority. I think everyone knows who's the boss there.
It's just whether they'll let him manage, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it's a bit of a dangerous game as well, you know, because Luis is one of Abramovich's favourites. You know, so if it goes wrong, it's going to look bad. And we're in this period, it's a dangerous time for Chelsea. Conte is not happy with the way things have gone. And, you know, we may well see him part company with Chelsea before too very long. But there is a great sense of Chelsea ever since they sacked Mourinho decades ago that managers don't matter. I think pretty soon they're going to find out they do.
Mm-hmm. I think sometimes we get sort of talked into saying that it's all about the players. It's all about recruitment. If you've got the right players, then you'll do well.
But players have to take responsibility. Yeah, yeah. You look at West Ham as an example. Those players are getting away with it.
Mm. Yeah, of course. But likes of Conte, I think it's great to see a manager sort of fiddle with things and make big decisions and sort of have an influence over over the team and say to everyone that, you know, I'm a great coach, I know what I'm doing here, because that's what you want to see. You know, you want to see a coach, I want to see a coach who can make the team a bunch of players a better team. You know, we talked about Sunderland before, you know, that's what you want in the club. When everything else is going wrong, when they haven't got the right players, when everything's going wrong upstairs, there's no leadership coming from upstairs, you want a manager that comes in and makes a difference in that team.
Manchester City, Pep Guardiola, 9 wins on the bounce. How does he make them better? Bit of a scary thought, by the way.
Well, I personally think, you know, if he plays with the midfield, they'd be even more fearsome. You know, I don't quite buy into this City, the greatest team we've ever seen. You know, the front 4 or 5 are just, you know, unbelievable, and the movements, the pace, and also the pressing, the way they press opposition defences, that allows the defence to play a very high line. I think the vulnerable there, I think you can get behind the defence. And I think there is a gap between the defence and the forward line. And often there's only Fernandinho in that area. And I think against the better teams, the problem is there aren't that many better teams. They'll get found out. But I think in this division, they'll...
Would you attack, for instance, the Otamendi's channel, that sort of left-sided channel?
Yeah, well, I think if you're looking for weaknesses, you're looking down that side, you're looking at Fabian Delph and trying to get at him, that's the way of doing it. But, you know, we talk about them defensively. I was reading some yesterday, it was about how many fouls are committed by teams. And they commit a lot of fouls when the ball's turned over from them. So they defend, when that's down to whether the tactical fouling or whether it's down to just the keenness to go in and win the ball straight back. I don't know about that.
Do managers consciously coach tactical fouling?
It's not something that's coached, but I think it's just something that's... I think it's a necessity of the game. I think, you know, you look at the game, what was it, Everton the other week? It was Everton-Leicester. You know, Demarai Gray, there was 3 opportunities they could have fouled him there. Davies first, Rooney and Gay. Yeah. It's just a part of the game, and you'd be naive not to use it, and especially if you're a team that's open to the counter attack.
I don't think it's explicitly said foul them, but you always hear the same thing, and you know, so to the players from some of the great teams say, you know, if they've got the ball and they're getting on top, break up the game. You know, disrupt the rhythm.
Manage the game.
And that essentially means foul them.
Yeah. With that Arsenal performance yesterday, did that actually emphasise even more Arsenal's irrelevance in terms of top four? Because, you know, they played within, you know, reasonable limits. It didn't look a 3-1 game to me. It wasn't there, but it looked a little bit more severe than that. Yet Arsenal, again... didn't turn up.
There's deep problems there. Where's the plan? You know, he buys Lacazette in the summer and he doesn't play him in a game like this. Mm. He comes on and scores. Ezra and Sanchez are out of here any minute. You know, and yet they're still the backbone of the team. We're told when Wenger signs a 2-year contract that they're going to put in a framework for the succession. And eventually comes, where's that? I don't see anything. I don't see any planning. I don't see any sense of progression for Arsenal. All I see is a club that's backsliding.
Begs the question, does Man City need Sanchez?
I don't think so. I mean, you've seen the reaction last year to, you know, to the troubles at Arsenal, his reaction, sort of isolating himself. And interesting, yesterday, seeing Ozil, I think it was Koscielny, he lost the ball, and Koscielny has a shout, starts shouting at him. And then he lip reads as he looks back at Koscielny and saying, you need to shut up, you speak too much. And I mean, when things like that happen between people, it's, you look between the lines and you see there's not a lot of, it'd be a lot of bit of trouble.
It points to the fallacy that you've got to keep these players no matter what.
Oh, you know what? I think the pair of them are a scandal. I mean, everyone says, well, you know, they criticise Ozil because of his lack of work rate. And you can see that. And the people praise Sanchez and say, oh, you know, he works so hard. But you know what? You can do the wrong sort of work. He dribbles down blind alleys. He shoots from outside the box through into crowded areas when a pass would be better. And you know what? Against Swansea last week, you know, he was... He plays a different game to his teammates. Mm. You know, it might be quite interesting to watch, but you know, it's not going to win you matches. And then at the end, while the Arsenal players clap the fans straight down the tunnel, he doesn't want to be there. You know what? Get him out. He's not that good.
That's where managers have got to earn the money as well. They've got to recognise the person's character, player's character. Now, it's quite possible that keeping hold of those two players, it's holding Arsenal back from moving forward. As much as it is, you know, people might think about Wenger, keeping Wenger there, they're not going to move on to the next step or to move into the next phase of Arsenal. Those two are the same. They, you know, until their futures are sorted, until they're away from the club, and they're not be able to bring people in to replace them so they can move on and go into the next phase, but because they're holding them back.
Would you sell Ozil to Man United and Sanchez to Manchester City if you're Arsene Wenger in January?
Look, I know a lot of people would say that you never sell to your rivals, but I mean, if you're getting the most money for them from those clubs as well. And we spoke about this the other week, you know, they're not close rivals at the moment. They need to get rid of those, get the money in, and then regroup and to bring more recruitments in, replacements in, so then it can move on again. I mean, they just don't look, even playing football, they don't look the same Arsenal side. You know, Man City are showing them up because they're showing, it's all about the little angles, playing through sides. Well, with Arsenal, everything was in straight lines. They're receiving the ball with the back to play and their own half trying to play out, and it's easy to press them, and they're just not the same football sides they were.
Mm. Whereas Spurs, you know, that win over Crystal Palace was as significant in its way as the win over Real Madrid, wasn't it? Because that was a getting the job done type of thing.
Good teams win after bad performances, and you know the opposite of Arsenal's happening at Tottenham. There is a plan, and everyone's playing to the plan, and you know, and it's working. And when you think about it, this team, the superstars have developed. They didn't start. They weren't acquired as superstars. You know, Harry Kane. You know, they sent him out on loan, tried to give him away a number of times. And Dele Alli, you know, brought him in as a kid with loads of potential. And they've grown into the team. You know, you don't have to go out and buy, you know, spend 70 million on you know, sort of big names to develop. And those players, even though Dele Alli hasn't had the greatest start to the season, they play within the framework that Pochettino has set up for them. And everyone knows the job. Everyone works hard. And you know, it was interesting that that Roy Hodgson said, he said, we matched something about Crystal Palace. We matched Tottenham's effort, he said, which is very hard to do, and it is, because this is a team that works. Arsenal don't work.
Mm. And it's the international break's actually come around quite nicely for them. Mm. Ali's got a couple of weeks to get that hamstring sorted out. I thought it very interesting that Pochettino made a point of saying, you've got to be cautious with Harry Kane. Harry Winks looks like he's got an ankle injury. It's 50-50 whether he's going to actually report for England. At least they've got a couple of weeks to actually take a breath.
Yeah, from a Tottenham point of view, it's great. From an England point of view, it's not, because you have those, take those players out the side. Mm. Okay, you can give other people a chance, but I mean, it's not like we're blessed with a lot of options when it comes to the England squad. Mm. But I think, you know, we spoke about Sullivan before and what's going on upstairs. Daniel Levy's done a hell of a job at Tottenham, you know. And I know he's been criticised for not competing with the bigger budgets in that league and splashing the cash. But it's been sort of it's been a marathon for them. They've got the young players in. They've had another eye, obviously, with the finances on the new stadium as well. So everything's been cannily done, you know.
Yeah.
And the thing is, they'll be quite looking forward to coming out of the international break because they've got Arsenal. Easy half volley.
Just a couple of talking points on an individual basis. Tony, I saw you were on social media last week, and this is a direct quote. The biggest change in the game in my lifetime, the idea that football is entertainment, that losing is somehow OK if it's pretty and winning can be dull. Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, when I grew up and started going to match, the only way you could see 90 minutes of football was going the game. There was very little on television. There was a highlight show. So it's and what going the match was about was, you know, you went with your friends, you could stand in a group. You know, it was a social thing as much as what was happening on the pitch. What was happening on the pitch was kind of incidental. Now, I think because of most people, let's use the buzzword, consume their football through television, it's created this sort of this idea that the highlights film is the apex of football, and all of a sudden we're seeing people criticised for not being entertaining, for perhaps playing defensively, and I think it's a crazy mindset. It's a modern mindset. It's not an attack on good football, but it's almost the fans who are like, I need to be entertained. Well, it was never like that. It was you went and you enjoyed it for what it was. And what was really interesting yesterday, I noticed that at Chelsea were 1-0 up and United were coming on towards the end. And they had the ball on the halfway line, passed it down on the left, and Chelsea pressed them really heavily, and they had to knock the ball back, and eventually it went back to De Gea, and the crowds were ecstatic. And you know what? It'll never make highlights film. It'll never be classed as entertaining. But it was a brilliant moment. The crowd loved it, and that's entertainment. I suppose what I'm trying to get at is that there are more than one way to play football. There's more than one way to enjoy football, and it's not just about attackers who beat people, who score goals. It's about a whole different thing. And I mean, I love seeing attacking football, but there's no obligation for teams to play it. And for fans to say that football's rubbish if they don't feel they've been entertained, to me, is just a really daft situation.
Part of our culture is the tribal loyalty towards a club. Sunderland's a club close to your heart, David. Is it an unmanageable club at the moment?
It's not that it's unmanageable, but the odds are stacked against, there's a lot of things stacked against anybody who comes in there. And I think that's the one reason why you want to talk about a manager who will make a difference. At the moment, there's no point mourning about the ownership because that's not going to change anytime soon. It's no point talking about the players at the moment because there isn't going to be a great overhaul of the squad. The finances aren't there to do that. There's too many players there on big contracts from the Premier League too. So that's got to change. So it needs a manager who can come in and make the difference. Now, I thought as much as anybody, Simon Grayson would have done that. At least would have steadied the ship, and that's what they were hoping. The ownership were hoping that he would make the sort of at least middle of the table championship, so they just regrouped, streamline the club for sell it on, and then the club can move on. Is it?
Who would you appoint?
The fan inside me probably would want to see somebody like Kevin Phillips and Peter Reid. I know they've been mentioned. I know it's a bit sort of, I don't know, you know, I don't want to look back too much, but things are so desperate there. At least if you had a partnership of Phillips and Reid, and Phillips was the head coach and Reid was above him, just guiding him. In the first couple of matches, home matches, there'd be a full house. There wouldn't be 26,000 there like there has been the last few weeks. There'd be a full house. Now then it'd be up to them to make sure that they kept them in there. But it's difficult to look far from Martin Bain for the answer, really. And anybody close to him or with close ties to him will certainly have a chance of getting the job.
Right. Some Questions from the listeners and viewers. We'll start with you, Tony. Cheeky one, Chelsea-related, from Paul McAwenny. Are any of the panel surprised Conte didn't hang around waiting for the gracious one to whisper nonsense in his ear again?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's the greatest relationship we've ever seen. You know, there's a they it's actually quite interesting watching their antics, you know, on the you know, in the technical areas. And I would say by the body language that they're not great mates. They won't be going out on the ale together, and neither will be the other's best man if they ever get married.
Yeah, because we do build up these rivalries, don't we, Dave? I get the impression with Pep and Mourinho that Pep's basically, oh, I'll have a pint of bothered, really. Mm.
You know. Oh, no, I said, I mean, as we mentioned this morning about the rivalry, then there's only one person who thinks there's a rivalry there, really, and that's Mourinho, because he's trying to whip up some sort of rivalry. He's trying to maybe affect Guardiola, but he'll never do that. Mm. I think it was really interesting. I love watching love watching the game. He was waiting outside, he was shaking hands with all the players, shaking hands. Mourinho was shaking hands with all the Chelsea players, all the staff, and then sort of Conte comes out and he didn't even look at him, just put his hand out and then walked away. And then you're right after the game. It was great just to see him. Mourinho was obviously looking for his hand, just go straight past him on the pitch. But that was brilliant.
Lovely. Another Man United question. Ronnie Williams is a Man United fan. What do you expect of Zlatan at 36?
Well, I think I think last year, for all his success and how well he did, I think he slowed the team down a little bit, which probably held back, you know, the likes of Rashford, Lingard and Martial a little bit. But he's got a huge presence in their area, and I think he'll still have that, and he'll score goals. And I have to say, looking at Lukaku again yesterday, his anticipation is off. He doesn't seem to know where the ball is likely to go, and that's the one thing that Zlatan will have. And his presence will help them. And I think if he can bring the younger players into the game a bit more, he could transform the season.
Mm-hmm. Talking to younger players, David. Jamie Jones has been on. This is obviously an injury-dependent question about Winks. With Winks in excellent form, will Southgate put him into central midfield and Dyer to centre-back, as Pochettino's done at Spurs? What do you think?
Well, he's done that well. I think he's got to do that. At least got to try him there. I think the fact that he's got so little experience, Premier League experience, but then all of a sudden, because he's playing well, being thrust in there and everyone's saying that he has to be in the side just shows you how thin on the ground we are for players, really, and for the squad members. But he's got to. I mean, he was so impressive, especially, I mean, two games against Real Madrid, against players. I mean, he's looking at his opposition and he's practically got posters of them on his bedroom wall, you know, like likes of Cruz and Modric. Yeah, and it is. And he's coming out and he's showing them how to play. And he's not looking out of place amongst the three of them. And I think Southgate has to put him in there and has to start preparing now for the.
Well, I think it makes sense. I mean, he tried the essentially five at the back system, and with players who are never going to be playing it. How stupid is that? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, try it with the team that's likely to need a plan B in the World Cup, and it seems to me that the obvious answer was to drop Dyer in. And do that with effectively your first team, and it gives you a view whether or where when it matters. This nonsense about doing it with your second and sometimes third stringers, it just didn't make any sense to me.
A related question, David, from Tim Smith, who points out that there were 16 England players involved in Champions League games last week. Does that bode well for the future?
It should do, but I mean, it's a totally different kettle of fish when they play for England as well. I mean, speaking about how England should play, where they should play on the counter attack, because they've got players who are used to playing that as well. I think that it's difficult to do that, because I mean, if you're a manager against opposition against England, you probably drop off us and let us have the ball. You know, and because I don't think we'd find it difficult to break teams down anyway. So I think it's it does bode well. I mean, like I said, it's especially from Tottenham's point of view. You've put Kyle Walker into that as well. They've done England a great service, haven't they?
Yeah. Sort of a related question here from Owen Mayers. Should England play counter-attacking football, given the success of Spurs and Liverpool in doing so? You know, quick transitions from defence to attack. Now, you need a strong core and pace. And Owen's thought is that we've got that. England have that. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a logic there. I think I think it would be a reasonable way to play. I think one of the things that has held England back for years and years is this idea that you've got to play at international pace. Yeah. My view is you look at the players you've got and say, the Premier League is 100 miles an hour. You know, these are the way these players play every week. Let's get the ball up quick. Let's make the transitions quick. Let's get the ball up. Let's close people down. Let's make these teams who want to play at a slower pace compete for the first ball and win the second ball and play the English game with them. And that's what I think would be more effective instead of let's stroll like we should do in internationals.
Mm. Yeah, but it's all dependent on the opposition though as well. Yeah. You know, if they're going to play a high pressing game as well, then it's obviously easier to play the counter attacking football. But not a lot of teams at international level do.
England this week, got their prestige friendlies. Mm. Okay, they've got their money making friendlies. The real game is at Windsor Park on Thursday night, Northern Ireland against Switzerland. How do you think they'll get on?
Well, I think they've got a chance. I think, if you look at the FIFA rankings, it looks as if, Northern Ireland will struggle. But Switzerland's have been, they haven't been great. They're a bit one-dimensional. And I think on a wild night in Windsor Park, they could get something there.
It just begs the question, what does Michael O'Neill need to do to get a club job?
It's almost like an actor who's been typecast, you know. He seems to be suited in that set of players and sort of that environment as well. It's quite telling that he doesn't get linked with a lot of jobs, especially even in Scotland where he's based as well. He's obviously doing a great job, and you like to think that a club with that style. I mean, you talk about Dyche going to Everton. Would he suit Burnley? Because it's almost a like for like and the same kind of sort of environment and philosophy as well. So perhaps something like that would come, but he still has to prove himself at club football. So you wonder whether he'd go in straight at that level.
Well, getting Northern Ireland to the finals would be the pinnacle. Surely you'll get a club job after that. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.